This is a HeadGum Podcast.
This episode of Gilmore Guys is brought to you by Squarespace. Now, whether it's GilmoreGuysShow.com or DoucheFireworks.com or RoryGilmoreSexboat.com, I love using Squarespace to build the websites. And I use Squarespace to build all those websites I just listed because it's so easy and simple. Sites look professionally designed regardless of skill level, and mine is very low. And no coding required. It's intuitive. It's got easy-to-use tools, and you get a free domain if you sign up for a year. So start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code GilmoreGuys to get 10% off your first purchase. That's squarespace.com, offer code GilmoreGuys at checkout. Welcome to Gilmore Guys. I'm Kevin.
I'm Demi.
We're the Gilmore Guys. And we're doing our special interview series, Gilmore Gabs, today. It's a special Gilmore Gab. It's a special day. There's a sort of symmetry to this day, right? With this particular show, the very first Gilmore Gab that we did, the very first interview we did, was with a musician, last name Phillips,
yeah,
who worked on Gilmore Girls. First name, Sam.
Sham?
Sham, I am. Not Grant Lee.
No.
Who could that be, Grant Lee? Okay, let's just turn to Dr. Seuss situation. All right, let's just introduce our special guest. Almost said it.
La la, la la, special guest.
Well, you may know him from Grant Lee Buffalo. You know him from music in general. And you may know him as the town troubadour in Stars Hollow. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up and welcome Grant Lee Phillips.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, gentlemen.
Woo! Oh, I gotta tell you. And you go by Grant, right?
Oh, you know what? Grant Lee's fine.
Grant Lee?
I think I might start going by Grant Lee. I mean, my mom calls me Grant Lee, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
So your mom...
You're welcome.
Thank you. So is that a thing like, you're in trouble? Grant Lee, get in here. Like
kind
that
of,
sort of thing?
Yes, okay. Yes. And I'm in trouble a lot, so.
But your friends call you Grant.
They call me both things, okay, to my face.
Okay, you know? Okay, okay. Sure. So it just, I guess it depends on whether we're more of a friend or a maternal figure.
We'll figure it out by the end of the podcast.
Yeah. Whether,
we have time.
Well, Grant, for now, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. One of the first things and one of the reasons I'm so delighted to do this podcast with you today is... your voice is kind of built for microphones, whether it be singing or just in orating in general. For those that may not know, there are not two, but three podcasters here in the room today. Because of course, Grant Lee Phillips had a podcast called Shortwave on the Earwolf Network.
Yeah.
A couple years ago.
Yeah,
right.
I know
so
that.
So That's talk
right.
about that.
Oh, goodness. I think it was Paul F. Tompkins that said, like, you know, everything would doing a podcast, you know, and I, well, you know what, I have kind of thought of that. And then, you know, I started talking with Scott Aukerman, and he was like, you know, I think you could do this. And kind of dipped my toe in it, you know?
Yeah. So Shortwave was this amazing interview series, pretty much, where you talk to, like, musical friends.
Yes. One-on-one with musicians talking music.
Amy Mann. At one point, Paul interviewed you.
That's
one
right.
of the episodes.
Yeah.
And it was this great series. It's still available, so everyone can check it out. It didn't go away. Do you feel like you would ever do something like that again in the future?
Yeah, or? You know what I mean? It gave me a lot of respect for what it takes to put together a show, because there's a lot that happens before, you know, we even push record, you know, getting folks together, all of that kind of stuff.
The coordination.
Yeah. That was the hard part, but I love doing it, and I love knowing what makes people tick.
Yeah.
You know?
But just in prepping for today, I was listening to that, and from moment one, welcome to Shortwave, I'm Grant Lee. It's just one of those voices that's really built for microphone.
And well,
thank
you.
Most people know you from singing, of course, and your music, but
I've listened a lot to the great announcers of our time, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Anyone from, you know, emulate, like the movie trailer guy
one of my
in
favorite,
a world.
One of my favorites is... For All Things Considered, I'm Robert Siegel.
That is good.
Thank you.
That's very good. I mean, you could try an Ira Glass, but it probably wouldn't work.
No, that's Glenn, that's tougher.
Grantley Phillips,
yeah.
Music, shortwave. That'd be tougher.
That's very good.
Oh, thank you.
I wonder if there's a sort of name for that sort of styling of voice. I want to say NPR voice, but I mean, it's just a sort of a gravitas to the voice. That
it
just
seems like it's like that kind of Nebraskan, yeah. You know, Midwestern, nasally, sinus-infected Johnny Carson kind of thing,
sick,
right?
Sick,
yeah. Because it's very close to Carson. When you think about it, it's very close.
Yeah.
Very
oh,
close.
Wow. Oh, man. Why is the town troubadour your only role, sir?
Yeah, what's happening?
What's going on? Okay, so like a Midwest. So where did you come from? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Northern California, a town called Stockton, straight up, you know, from Los Angeles, about 5.5 hours.
Okay.
Farm country.
Right on. Okay, yeah. So you were a bit of a farm boy?
I suppose I was. Yeah. I mean, I grew up, you know, around all those orchards and moved away when I was 19, packed my Plymouth Satellite full of my banjo and my amplifier, my guitar, my ventriloquist dummy, mm-hmm. and some magic tricks.
Wait, one of those doesn't belong. One of those doesn't belong. I think one of these things is not like the other. Yeah, what's a guitar doing in there?
Yeah, you're right.
You had magic tricks and a ventriloquism dummy.
Yeah. Okay, yeah,
so,
my Charlie McCarthy and my banjo.
So you were just like a performer then?
I knew it. I knew my fate had something to do with performing, and I enrolled in film school in L.A. for like a year. And,
at USC?
No, there was a place called Columbia, right next to Pink's Hot Dogs, which I think they've moved now. But, you know, it was cool. But I was roofing houses during the day and going to this film school at night and mm-hmm. And I said to myself, this is hard. I got to do what comes naturally. I've got to do the music thing now. I can wait till I'm old and gray, and then I can maybe, you know, maybe I can learn about film then. But right now I want to just perform.
Because was the original aim to be a director or a writer?
I thought it might be, you know. I mean, I think, yeah, because I always drew pictures and I liked playing. And I thought maybe film is the place where you can put it all together. And you can, but it takes like, you know, an army to do it. And the thing I found about the guitar is that I can just sit down with the guitar and nobody can tell me that I can't write that song. Well, they can tell me, but I'll still do it.
They'd be rude if they didn't.
So something about that immediacy and that sense of empowerment, you know.
I connect with the idea of the thing about immediacy, which of course, as we know now, is like such a double-edged sword with technology and stuff. But the idea of doing low-tech things, like even for this podcast, it doesn't take a lot. Like in this room, we probably have, you know, for the equipment we're using, it's all less than like $1,000 total. And we can put this up tomorrow and get feedback on it immediately.
Right.
Has the technology element of how music is distributed changed the way you create or experience music?
Yeah, I suppose it has. I mean, you know, I mean, it's put me in touch with the people that listen to my stuff. You know, I'm frequently on Facebook and all that kind of stuff, you know. And yeah, I mean, I like that idea. You know, it's like having your own little radio station or something. I mean, you know, as you say, it's a double-edged sword. It's been kind of the doomsday for those of us that put our work out in the world and, you know, and try to get paid for it, you know.
Yeah.
Because you do kind of alternative distribution models now, right?
I felt like I was very quick to jump on putting my own albums out and embracing, you know, this idea of you could put it out yourself, go on the road, sell it. And this was after I'd already been with major labels. And I thought, you know what? The frontier is really this other thing, you know, the do-it-yourself thing, which always attracted me anyhow. So, yeah, I've been embracing that, I think, for a long while. But it keeps changing, you know. Year by year. I don't know what it all means.
I don't know if you would remember, but do you have any sort of memory of the first songs or even one of the first songs you wrote? Like whether you were just like messing around on the guitar and in your room when you were like a kid or?
Yeah. I picked up the guitar when I was about 13 or 14 and almost immediately began to kind of, oh, I recognize that sounds like that song, you know, that chord. And so I think I probably started off by trying to like replace the words of other people's songs, you know, almost like a song parody.
A little Weird Al.
A little bit of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there was a song called Mr. Bojangles. And so I rewrote it as Mr. Bald Ankles, a story of an elderly streaker. So streaking was quite the fad at this time, you realize, in the late 70s. So, yeah. And then I realized, well, that's what you do, you know. You just come up with words. I listened to Elton John records, and I couldn't make out a word. He was...
Isn't it funny how he does not sing with an accent?
It is funny. I think about that sometimes when performers don't have accents, and then you hear them talking. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, oh, I didn't realize.
Or sometimes it goes the opposite way, yeah. where they don't have an accent speaking, but then they'll adopt one.
Yeah,
singing.
I've had different accents at different times. Yeah. You know, when I was younger, when I was, you know, 14, I had a very thick English accent when I sang.
Really?
Out in the country, out in the farmlands. Yeah, and I
what
go, it, try
so
to,
you like
I, so could I listened to a bunch of Bowie, you know, and Queen, and
yeah.
so I'd show up, you know, to somebody's barn with my guitar, and like, you know, let's do it, mates. That's it. You
know? As a farm
boy
from? In California,
I'm from here.
I'm from the stars, my brother.
Yes,
from the stars.
Oh man, so. Well, what was kind of the first big break after you kind of took that left turn away from film school, away from what the original track was? You were doing roofing at the time. And what was the
first big? Oh, well, boy, I don't know. It's kind of like I guess it was. I moved to LA in the '80s, right? And there's a lot going on. There was this sort of bubbling underground kind of thing. You know, all these bands, the Paisley underground scene was kind of happening. You know, bands that were kind of doing their version of 60s psychedelia and mm-hmm. you know, garage bands and all that kind of stuff, and that seemed like
in the 80s.
In the 80s, and it was two very different warring tribes of you know, the heavy metal bands with the big hairsprayed, you know, look on
oh, sure.
the strip,
yeah,
and then this other scene that was very different than that, you know, and I don't know what kind of products they were using
in their hair,
but more of a manic panic kind of scene.
Oh, sure, yeah, yeah.
And anyhow, it just sort of, you know, through that, my little band that I played the guitar in called Shiva Burlesque, we were kind of like a post punk neo psychedelia, you know, kind of thing, and we had a little record deal, and then maybe like about 92 or something. That's when Grantley Buffalo, the band that a lot of folks know me from, that's when we signed our deal and very quickly found ourselves touring and, you know, overseas a lot and making videos and you know, pretending that, you know, we were capable of doing interviews and all that kind of stuff.
Now, the band name, Grantley Buffalo.
Yeah.
Because Grant Lee, I get
yeah,
that.
That,
I see,
right.
I see
right.
where that comes from. I'm yes. tracking with you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got Buffalo.
Yeah.
Coming out of nowhere.
Yeah, right.
Where did that come from?
Where'd
I guess it didn't come out of nowhere.
It didn't really come out of nowhere. I think I have a pretty vivid memory of assembling a lot of visual materials, you know, that were stimulating me at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, postcards and old photographs and, you know, things from magazines and history books. And I was always really drawn to American history and especially the story of, you know, Native American history. And so the buffalo was kind of extracted from that. And in the beginning, it almost allowed me to adopt a character in terms of my writing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What would Grantley Buffalo have to say, you know? And
because you yourself have a Native American ancestry.
I do, yeah, I do. Yeah, it's part of my ancestry. And I thought, well, this is kind of like, this is giving me a certain path to go down.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I had a little postcard up in the wall, dull knife, you know, and all of these other things. And it almost looked like one of those, you know, like when you go into some kind of serial killer's underground lair and there's all of these.
Of course, you know how you do.
Magazines, yeah. You know how you do that, you know. Well, you connect the dots with the string and mm-hmm. the push pins. I had that kind of thing, you know, and it was sort of my visual sort of map for what this music should sound like. Funny, isn't it? I mean,
and the buffalo was the most outstanding.
Yeah,
I guess Grantley
I think so.
Dole Knife would not have as good of a
No. Yeah. I think I did the numerology. Came out to like an 11 or something. It made sense.
Oh, it went yeah. to 11.
Yeah. This one goes to 11, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So that was that band. And then just in general, like with the track to Gilmore Girls.
Yeah.
Where did that come? Like, where would you say you were in your career when that opportunity came about? Because this was probably, you were in it since season one.
Was I? Really?
I mean, believe so.
Yes. It was something like that. Or yeah.
So Amy, we're talking 2000, 2001.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Amy and Amy Sherman-Palladino, Daniel, they had kind of tracked Grantley Buffalo and followed me into my own. I began a solo career maybe the end of 99.
Mm-hmm.
Buffalo had made four albums and it was time for me to spread my wings.
Was that scary to break off after having done
oh,
it?
Oh, yeah.
And you're playing everywhere and you have yeah. all this measure of success. And then, like, what is it? What's the inciting thing that leads you to, okay, I got to go solo?
I think it's because, you know, for me, all of it kind of like, it all is an outgrowth of writing songs, and I kind of had to, and that's a very singular kind of activity. Mm. You know, it often begins just like how we're here, sitting on a couch with a guitar. And so it's, I don't know, that's kind of where I have to work from. And I think maybe it's such an intense experience when you're with a band, and you're, especially when you're playing like the same one or two albums over and over and over. And I felt like I got so many other types of music in me I got to explore, or I'll go crazy, you mm-hmm. know? I don't know. I'd heard Bjork, and I wanted to make music with robots. And, you know, I figure there's more I have to explore, you know? Music, that's the creative part, you know, feeling like you've landed on some kind of new idea.
Yeah, and there's so much more latitude for that as yeah. a solo. It's easier to move as one unit than three or five, or
I think
whatever
so.
The case may be.
I think so. You know, now, having said that, I feel like I've kind of, in some ways, kind of come full circle, and I've re-embraced a lot of the things that, you know, the singing with the acoustic guitar, telling stories, mm-hmm. and just, you know, a lot of those things that I might have even resisted at the tail end of the band, you know?
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, yeah, like, no, I want to make music with some other kind of...
But then I guess that period was probably necessary, too.
Yeah.
Because you have to go out to come back home, in a way.
Exactly.
See what's out there musically, creatively.
Yeah.
What were some of the most fruitful things that came of that time that were like, that kind of were scary to you, like on a creative or musical level?
Oh, goodness. I mean, you know, I made an album called Mobilize, and it's kind of a hybrid record. And it was the first kind of solo album. I had done one album, an acoustic one, prior, but Mobilize was the first one that was really going to be put out there, you know, in a decent fashion, you know. And I didn't use a band. I did it, you know, using programming and drum machines. And so I kind of got myself out on a limb, a really exciting place to work from, though. Carmen Rizzo, who works here in L.A., he produced it with me. And so that was scary. I felt like, is it really a record? I mean, worse, there's no tape? What? Where it's going to be on a computer? I mean, all of this stuff felt really, like, really foreign at that point, you know? And then soon after, around that same time, I get this call from the Gilmore Girls. And, you know, I had that interest in, you know, as I said, magic tricks and ventriloquist dummies. So this was like...
Mm. It was all part of the same creative impulse.
Well, yeah. I felt like this is a chance to kind of just play and act and all that other kind of stuff, you know, so...
How was it pitched to you? Because you got the call. It's not like they had Town Troubadour tryouts and then you just showed up.
No, that's true.
They sought you out specifically for it.
A person who they had communicated with said, like, can you give these guys a call? They're interested in talking with you. And it was sort of like that, you know, are you interested in being our Town Troubadour? And very early in, if you recall, I did an episode or two of it. And then they concocted this great scenario where Dave Gruber, Alan and I,
oh yes, the troubadour
lock horns, oh, yeah. you know, oh, over yeah. troubadour turf, and that was, man, that was fun.
Yeah, that might, because that was really I think that's the first time you spoke
yeah,
on
it's
the show.
First time I spoke,
yeah, on camera.
It's in my baby book.
Yeah, that's yeah. right, in your acting baby book. Was that scary though? Because mm-hmm. up to this point, you've toured, you've done all this performing, but you've never spoken on camera. You've never had a story on a TV show that people
no,
are watching.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite different doing music videos where you just have to, you know, hit your mark and all that kind of stuff.
And mouth it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I mean, believe me, I really tried to, like, you know, learn my lines and be on top of it. And
prepare, go through the actor's pain.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. Started, like, at 4 a.m, and I think maybe that scene, you know, probably ended at about 2 a.m, long day. And
4 to 2?
It was a long day.
Oh
I mean, maybe
gosh.
I'm exaggerating, but like, you know, and little by little, you know, you would see, you know, the lead actors kind of go away. And until ultimately about 2 a.m, I'm delivering my lines for real. Now, I've said them 1,000 times that mm-hmm. day, but now I'm delivering them to a folding chair. And, you know, like, why you... You know,
oh, to do the reverse.
To do the actual, yeah. scene, you know. It might have been, well, Gruber and I were there, and then a folding chair. And mm-hmm. But man, and I love him. I mean.
Had you known him before working with him on
Yeah, I had actually made that suggestion, you know. There was, here's a bit of trivia, a bit of Gilmore trivia.
Oh, sure.
There was talk of Robin Hitchcock being the other troubadour.
Oh, interesting.
And Robin is a buddy of mine, and we were touring together around that same time, but he was in London, and so we said, well, what else? What else could we do, you know? And I said, what about Dave, you know? And that's how that happened, and lo and behold, that kind of
stuff. So you were responsible for that. And then he was in a few other episodes as well.
Yeah, yeah.
What a good find. He's one of those guys that are just so reliable. Anything you see them in.
When he pops up, you get delighted. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what's fun? And he pops up in reality. I almost convinced that he's some sort of like archangel. When my wife, when we were rushing her to the hospital in Burbank, when she was about to have our daughter, and we rush in, and there at the bus stop, I say, "That's a Dave, you know." How you doing? And
that's a good Dave
by a Gruber.
and then so we went in, and then like a couple of days later, we come out of the hospital. Now there's three of us, our little daughter, and there's Dave out there. Like
he was waiting.
How you doing? Got a little baby child.
Overseeing the whole deal.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
terrific.
So he
just pops up. I mean, I started to feel like he's an apparition. He's some kind of just very benevolent being that pops up.
Maybe he's going to pop up here after this podcast is done.
It would not be surprised.
Yeah, this would be the ideal.
It's like the opposite of seeing a black cat run across. You're just like, oh, the Gruber.
Yeah.
Today's going to be a good day.
It's right. Yeah.
It's true. For the show, because oftentimes your role, it wasn't background. Oftentimes you were the establishing shot of so many scenes. Okay, so we're in the town center of Stars Hollow, and we're starting on the Troubadour for a good minute and a half, 2 minutes of just performance.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a rare thing in TV.
It is, yeah. I felt like, you know, I was kind of a one-man Greek chorus, you know? And sometimes it felt like the song was just kind of, in some way, almost commenting or, you know, juxtaposed against that scene.
Well, that's what I want to ask about, because I'm sure with any television production, it's so complicated how these decisions are made sometimes in terms of what can we get music-wise, what are the rights, actually performing it, syncing it up, doing the takes, blah, blah, blah. So what was the creative process in even just choosing a song? Was that up to you at all, or was that all the writing team?
It always, I mean, by and large, it began with a conversation. You know, we've got this situation coming up where this is happening, you know, dramatically. And what do you think? What is that, you know, any ideas, you know? And I would say, well, you know what? Maybe this would work, you know, or maybe this would work. Try this too. And we would just kind of weed through it, you know, and find the right moment. Now, sometimes Amy would have a very firm idea to begin with, and that would be, we would go from that point, you know?
Sure.
I mean, for instance, like, I often did my own songs, but sometimes they would create an idea where a town troubadour is singing "Wake Me Up Before You Go Go," a Wham song.
Or
a Paul Simon song, something like that, you know.
Or Me and Julio Down in the Schoolyard.
Yeah, exactly.
So that sort of thing. So those were the ones that are covers are probably more specifically.
I think so, yeah. But yeah, I mean, generally there was always a great like dialogue, you know.
Okay, that's cool. So it still feels like a collaboration, not just like,
yeah, definitely.
Do this song for me, play for me.
No. Yeah. Uh-uh. There's it's always been really creative. And I mean, boy, I mean, the sense of detail is, it's really staggering. It's something that I really respect about her whole process.
Yeah.
Nothing left to chance or just, you know, the devil's in the details.
Well, and the details too of having to do a show with, and not that you had it, unless it was one of your storylines, but to do a show with such crazy, insane, word-perfect dialogue, so literate. So
yeah.
So there would be these long, like, tracking shots throughout the town, sometimes starting or ending with you.
Yeah.
So maybe this is a boring question for some people. I don't care. I'm still super interested in it.
Yeah.
But, like, for sync and playback, is that all live?
Yeah, well, you know, that's, yeah, I mean, there's some mechanical aspects to that, mm-hmm. you know, but yeah, you're right. I mean, for one, you can't blow it when the last thing, you know, that could go wrong is you.
Did that ever happen?
I don't believe so. I mean, I'm sure I dropped a line at some point, you know,
right.
But generally the music, you know, that part of it mm-hmm. went smooth.
But it was always live playing on the set. You were never syncing up.
You know what? Well, sometimes what I mean, the way it works is that you need to have everything in sync. And you might have a situation where, say, the song begins, I'm playing it acoustically, mm-hmm. but it's going to seamlessly segue into a recorded version of the song, you know, like you would hear on an album or something like that.
Oh, in that case. Okay, yeah, yeah.
You know, I would sometimes pre-record it on the set live, and then I would play back and have to sing that. But that has its own challenges, too. I mean, the honest truth, there's a variety of ways that mm-hmm. it would take place depending on the demands and the freedom of the scene.
Yeah, well, that is one thing I appreciate about the show, though, is that it never looked lip-synced at all.
Right.
It never looked artificial. Even with the other band stuff, like Hep Alien or the Cavalcade of Troubadours later, it all looked very live.
Yeah.
So, and I think the idea of recording live on the set and then syncing to that, I think most people would do it, record in studio and then sync it.
Right.
Live. So
right.
That's another one of those.
I mean, a lot of it is going down live. And then, you know, sometimes, as you say, it's done kind of in the same environment, you know, because that's mm-hmm. part of it as well. I mean, especially here, we got like airplanes flying over and, you know, delivery
that'd
trucks.
That'd be a bummer if that was in the sync track.
Well, it is probably in there, you know, more than you would realize. The sound of the birds.
Yeah. and so for that stuff. Because they would use you sparingly, but I guess it's different because you live in Nashville now. Correct?
I do. I at one point up until 2013, I lived just down the street in Burbank.
What inspired the move?
You know what? That's a good question. I think several things. You know, I tour quite a bit. You know, as a you know, somebody who makes records and mm-hmm. goes out and plays. So that was a good thing, you know. Move to a place where there's a lot of music going on, but it's easy to get in and out by car or by airplane, and the cost of living is a lot more affordable, mm-hmm. and it's a really great musical community.
Yeah,
you know, and I love a lot of the music that came out of there over the years as well. You know, a lot of great instrumentalists, and so all of those things.
Yeah, I mean, how would you describe it now? Because I think most people, when they hear Nashville, they just think, oh, it's country, it's honky tonk, it's bluegrass.
Yeah.
But it's actually probably quite more diverse than
it's
that.
It's a little more diverse. It's kind of like, you know, one part country bear jamboree.
Who could forget the classic country bear jamboree?
But we have our share of steampunk, apron wearing, mustachioed baristas. So there's kind of like a cool kind of clashing of hipsters and, you know, and country bear.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nashville is where country bear and hipster meet.
Yeah.
They should put that on the, yeah. That could be a postcard right there.
Do you feel like maybe hipsters have been a little bit kind of maligned as of late?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, it's a misnomer, right?
It's a misnomer.
Because hipster, I think some people conflate the attitude with the apparel, right?
Right.
Like some people, oh, your jeans are a certain way. You're a hipster.
I'm so glad that there's a generation of folks that have brought back, you know, I don't know, barber poles and spats.
Yeah.
And, you know, what else have they brought back?
Just the idea of retro, the idea of cycling back through a different, what's it going to be next?
Yeah.
Because now,
artisans, people who take great care in making a grilled cheese, you know, or
right.
Why not?
The artisan grilled cheese sandwich, of course.
That's
a lot of those
Nashville's
in Portland.
About.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah, it's all about the grilled cheeses.
Is it? Yeah.
Is it weird, the first thing I think of now, because I haven't been in, have you been to Nashville?
I haven't.
I haven't been to Nashville either. And the first thing I think about now, in terms of like a vision of Nashville, is this episode of Master of None, where the main characters, and they shot on location.
Master of Knives?
Master of None. Master of Knives would be a very cool show. It's an Aziz Ansari show on Netflix.
It would have been yours if you went with Dull Knife, though.
That's true. You would have been the Master of Knives.
Master of Knives.
I also think of Belmont, the college, just because I have a lot of friends that go there. And that's what sort of changed my attitude of Nashville being like a country town to all sorts of music.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
We're thinking about going out there and doing a show in Nashville at some point. We have no plans currently.
Yeah, we say we're thinking about it. We mean we'd like to.
We want to. We want to go to Nashville and Atlanta.
You should.
Yeah.
I welcome you.
They have like beautiful venues there, right?
They do. Yeah, they have a lot of venues. Yeah.
So we're looking for something for like comedy and something kind of old. Something like Talia Hall would be cool.
Yeah.
But
we'll figure it out.
To the original point. So was there like an agreement in Gilmore Girls or like an understanding of like episodes per season are like, hey, we're going to use you for these? Or was it just, were you kind of, because you were local, it was like, oh, we'll bring you in when we need you?
I think it was more like that. Yeah. You know, whenever it felt right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There was a very fun story near the end of season six, the season six finale, where the town troubadour gets a gig opening for Neil Simon. Or Neil Simon. That'd be a totally different thing.
Paul Simon. Yeah. Neil Young. Neil Diamond.
Neil Diamond, Simon, Paul Young.
Yeah.
And then it gets flooded. The town gets flooded with a bunch of troubadours.
Yes.
Now, creatively, was that all... Do you remember those days? Because those must have been insane days to work on the show.
I do.
With all the music talent, Sonic Youth and all those guys. Yola Tango, Daniel taking a swing at being a troubadour as well. There is a fun Daniel cameo.
Yeah? Yeah. I didn't know Yola Tango was in there.
Yeah.
That's fun.
Yeah, there was a bunch of them. Sparks... I believe Marilyn Raskub was.
That's right.
Marilyn Ricecub. Yeah. I said Raskub.
Raskub.
That's kind of how it's
Rice
spelled.
Cube. Yeah. Also, someone from like the Largo scene.
Yeah, right. Yeah. She's a very dear old friend from the Largo days.
Was
yeah.
that your sort of. Because you talked about kind of the divisions in the 80s, and obviously Largo wasn't around then, but was the Largo scene. Because there seems to be this kind of cabal of great people that all seem to have congregated around. You're talking about you're doing Paul F. Tompkins' show tonight, a friend of ours and a friend of the show. And that scene, the Amy Mann and John Bryan and Michael Penn, and how did that scene come about? Were you a part of like the uprise of that scene?
Yeah, most definitely. And I don't know. I mean, it was a lot more organic than you might suppose, I guess. I was playing Largo maybe like very, very early 90s. You know, the fellow who ran it, he had other clubs in town, and I had played some of his
Flanagan?
Other clubs. Even before Flanagan.
Oh,
yeah, a fellow named Jean-Pierre had a place called Lassa Club and mm-hmm. Lassa Land. And then he had what was called Cafe Largo, which was more of a, you know, very different than the rock clubs, mm-hmm. you know, more of a cabaret place where you'd see, you know, fire eaters and...
Oh boy!
You know, belly dancers. And okay. I said, this is where I belong. Yeah. I'm more in this scene, you know.
Bring up the dummy.
Yeah, right. Metal, I'm still kind of holding out that maybe ventriloquism is something to fall back on.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, not fall out on. But anyhow, so we were playing there, and Flanagan walked in one night with his partners and said, like, you know what? And he'll tell you the story. You know, I think I found the place. You know, this is where I see my, you know, the club mm-hmm. of my dreams happening right here. And and he really cultivated a great situation where, I don't know, where the artists felt as though they were appreciated. He would feed us. He would give us bowls of pasta. Mm-hmm. And
he was like a little den mother.
Yeah. You know, I mean, just a real kind of like, you know, like your ideal kind of like coach, you know. And,
oh, sure. Yeah.
And, you know, such a good friend. And and through Largo, that's when I met John Bryan and so many folks who were like, you know, I go way back with. And yeah, E from the Eels was playing there a lot, and mm-hmm. You know, in those days. And then eventually, you know, more comedians began to come in. And that's when I met Paul and Mary Lynn, Greg Barrett. And
there seems to be like a good amount of cross-pollination in those groups.
Yeah.
Too. I think there didn't seem to be as much clicky. Like Paul would open for Grand Lee Buffalo,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, Paul would, yeah. Yes, he even opened for us at a very difficult New Year's Eve show.
Oh, I think I know this. Oh, you should tell it. It's so terrific.
Paul tells it the best and everything, but it kind of culminated with him in full tux and tails and top hat.
Of course.
Being pelted with ice.
Oh.
You know? I'm not sure who was doing the pelting, you know? It's kind of like the Sanders thing, right? I don't know that was... Those were Buffalo supporters pelting Paul Tompkins with ice.
They weren't right. True Buffalo supporters if they were pelting with ice.
No, I don't think so. That doesn't sound like our crowd, really. Right. You know?
But it seems like a tougher situation. Like music opening for a comedy act, people are usually on board with. Seems cool, seems rad. But comedy opening for music seems a little tougher. Did you have other openers that were more comedic besides Paul?
Oh, well, it doesn't get more comedic than Paul. But no, not... Well, you know what? I take it back. At the old Largo, I think Zach... Open up the show, mm-hmm. Zach Galifianakis. I'm pretty sure Patton Oswalt would have as well, yeah. You know, Karen Kilgariff, mm-hmm. Greg Barron, a whole bunch of them, you know. And I look upon guys like yourself and these folks, they're stepping up there without any protection, you know. There's no shielding of a guitar to hide behind. I've always got that guitar I can go to. But so I think for that reason, musicians really look upon comics with this kind of wow, you know, just like walking into the war zone with, you know, with nothing to hide behind.
Yeah. And then you got another crowd, which is the comedian musicians, your Weird Al's or your Nicktoons.
Yeah. It seems like that's kind of like, am I right? It seems like maybe that is more, there's greater acceptance, greater tolerance of the musical comic today than there might have been.
It used to be ghettoized, but I think guys like Tenacious D and Fly of the Conchords made it very, I don't know, not popular, but just less, just more respected, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because there was true art. I guess the Tenacious D guys were a part of that community back in the day, too.
And funny, I mean, I see bands like Milk Carton Kids. Mm-hmm. They're very funny, you know, very funny guys. They're doing mostly music, but in between, though, it's, you know, it's great.
Cracking jokes, cracking wise.
Yeah.
I guess like Steve Martin does basically a little stand-up bits in between playing banjo.
I mean, it's all about just, you know, avoiding drowning on stage, you know. However you do it, it's survival.
Do you get bantery on stage in between songs?
Bantery? I'm known to. And then I have nights where I feel like I'm just going to go deep.
Oh, boy. Yeah, but well, because now is it mostly like band gigs or solo gigs that you're playing when you're out there?
Well, mostly solo, you know, all the way. Occasionally I'll have friends join me, you know, but a lot of it's by myself. And so that's kind of brought me out of my, you know, whatever my comfort zone might have been when I could step up on stage with a band and there was a smoke machine and some good lights. You take all that away and it's just a microphone, then I don't know. Then it gets a lot more real, you know, a lot quicker. So,
do you find it's easier to connect with audiences that way?
Yeah, when there's less in between. Yeah. Very hard to connect with an audience through a smoke machine.
I would imagine there'd be some
I used to bring my
issues.
Smoke machine wherever I went, into Largo, actually. You know,
is that
folks
true?
Were enjoying their thrice-baked chicken, you know, and the penny, and then just douse them, and this, you know, just a fumigation.
Why do you think that Largo scene, because, I mean, you're doing a show there tonight. What do you think it is about it that's kept it intact over all these years? And has kept people, even like the guys who have gone into huge... Like Jay Oswald and Apatow and Galifianakis, but they're still all a part of that and still do shows there and seem pretty tightly knit.
I think it's, you know, this is a big city and it's hard to come by a sense of family and community. And a lot of us, we've left our actual family and we've come across, you know, the country. And so there is that, you know. The sense of like finding a few people that you really see eye to eye with, you know, I think a lot of it is that, you know, and also, you know, Largo has evolved, you know, the Largo at the Coronet is a little different than the old Largo, but I think that leap, on Flanagan's part to like, well, let's try something a little different. Let's shake it up. You know, there's new blood coming in all the time, you know? There's a lot of old timers as well, but there's always new stuff happening.
Old vets. It's just cool to see something like that keep intact, and it seems mostly untouched by too much of the, you know, typical LA things.
Yeah, maybe so.
Like you've found an equivalent to that, or something, if not an equivalent, something similar to that since moving from LA in Nashville?
No, not really. You know, I think it's really quite unique to LA. And it's funny that it exists in LA in some ways, you know. Moving back here, you know, I've lived here for 30 years. Mm-hmm. Now I live out in the country where, you know, it's such a different pace. Mm-hmm. Being here, I realized, man, you got to really grow this sort of lead shielding on your nerves to deal with everything here, you know, the traffic, parking, living, all that stuff. Yeah. And then you have a place like Largo where you can kind of forget all that once you're there, you know, and once you're there, it's kind of like, you know, probably not all that different than it would have been, you know, in the 1930s at a place like the Coronet, you know.
Yeah, grab the seats certainly aren't.
No, the seats have not been changed since then, I don't think.
I truly think they have not.
But you're more apt to hear somebody on stage just playing, you know, with one microphone, if that, and it's, I love that.
it almost kind of ruins you for other venues, truthfully. Like,
does it?
Like, for me, like, when I see a really amazing acoustic set there, you know, just because it's so much about focus and attention.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It's so, you know, and as a performer, I'm sure you found, like, the Largo audiences are just so attentive and focused. And
yes. Well, they've been yelled at a lot over the years. So that's, you know, a certain amount of conditioning.
They've been corralled into
them. Yes, right. But yeah, you're right. I mean, that's, they're conditioned for that. I mean, it's cool what you can do with just with very, very little, you know, give us a stage and that's, and we don't even need a stage, you know, we'll hit the road. If we don't have a road, we'll hit the ground.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
How do you feel like Gilmore Girls affected your career? Because all the while you were on it for the 7 original seasons, not including the Netflix stuff, you were still touring, making your music, doing all that stuff. Did you find any sort of differences in the crowds or audiences that came to your shows?
Yeah, I mean, I and this happens the world over. I was in Germany recently, and I get kids who come, who arrive early with their DVDs, their Gilmore DVDs.
Oh, wow.
You know, in Hamburg, and they come with their parents, you know, they've experienced the show together and it's great, you know, so I don't believe that I would have been able to, you know, attract them in any other way. And it's quite a great introduction, actually.
Yeah, I think so, because I think probably for a lot of original viewers, including myself, who grew up and watched it when I was a kid, the show was kind of a Trojan horse for other...
A Trojan horse. I think that's great. Yes.
Right. But it's
sort of subversive, really. You know? The idea that, like, you're about to be exposed to a band like Sonic Youth.
Yeah.
Through a very, you know, wholesome offering of entertainment. And Sonic Youth are, you know, lack anything in terms of being wholesome. But, you know, I mean, they're really kind of like a progressive, interesting, you know, band, and that you're not very mainstream, right? Quite outside of the mainstream, but
I mean, it really is kind of like an education in music. I mean, I think the first time I heard an Elvis Costello song was that season 2 episode,
right,
where they played This Is Hell.
Boy, if you had a pen and paper and you were watching a Gilmore Girls and you made a note of like, what, I gotta check that out. Okay, who is that? Sylvia Plath. Okay, gotta check that out.
Oh, we Sonic literally Youth, do that for Iggy every Pop, episode.
You know, I mean, boy, you would have like a long laundry list of things that could potentially kick your life in a very different direction.
Pop culture school.
Yeah, a little pop culture. Did you?
Yeah.
Did you watch the show while it was on? Were you like a fan of it or watch it otherwise besides working on it?
Well, most certainly. You know, I mean, I was introduced to it pretty early on when I was working on it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, most definitely I've followed. I've seen it to this day. I see, that I get into my hotel room and sometimes at 1 in the morning in Hamburg again.
Oh, sure.
You know, there it is, you know, dubbed.
A lot of time another you spend apparition. In Hamburg. Yeah.
Another apparition.
And then Dave Gruber comes out and he says, "Hey, watching Gilmore Girls?" And you know, it's going to be a good night in Hamburg.
That's right.
Well, given that you've watched the show,
there is something we are obligated to ask all of our guests and something we're interested in finding out.
What
is
that?
Are you Team Dean, Team Jess, or Team Logan?
As far as all of Roy's boyfriends go,
if
you had to choose one that you feel is right and best.
You know what? I kind of miss Team Dean.
Really?
I kind of do.
Dean, again.
It seems like a lot of...
He was the first, he'll be the last.
Maybe.
Wasn't he the first? I don't know.
He was the first, yes.
He was the first.
Yes.
Yes.
Definitely.
But, I don't know. Some kind of phenomenon happened, right?
I mean, there's a little bit of magic to your first, I guess.
Yeah. Right. You never forget your first Rory boyfriend.
How could you?
You never forget your first Rory boyfriend, as the saying goes.
Yeah.
It seems like a lot of times when we have guests on that were involved in the show, they tend to agree that Dean was the best. And
really?
We're surprised because we don't like Dean, but...
I don't know. It's hard. It's hard to warm up as a gentleman, you know, to a guy with, you know, that great hair and cheekbones.
Yeah.
You know, we don't like that.
You feel a sense of competition.
Yeah.
It just brings out something.
Not even for Rory. Just like I want you. I want to be you.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
You project yourself onto that. Well, and the whole reason we're talking to you today, and the reason you're in town, is, and I don't think it's a secret.
Yeah.
But you have returned to Stars Hollow in some capacity.
In some capacity, I have.
You have returned.
It's very secretive, you know. I mean, it's like locked down.
Yeah, what is your
Pentagon stuff?
You know? Really? I mean, if you got a script, was your name like watermarked all over it?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, they're really taking prevent. This is no WB fun and games. This is some Netflix. Next level,
yes.
Stuff. What? Well, well,
they could disappear me. I mean, very easily.
They will. They won't. But just being in broad strokes, of course, without giving anything away. What was the experience of coming back and shooting this show like after having not been in this context and working with these people after 8 years? What was that experience like?
It's wild, you know. I mean, for one, I never ever got rid of the jacket that I wore. You know, I never got rid of the little
jacket.
Yeah, my checkered coat, and then I had this other contraption that I wore, a little portable amplifier. I hung on to that stuff because it was stuff that I built and that I found. And
oh, that you provided for the show. Didn't give those to you.
When I put that stuff on, it was like the suit, right? It's like the Batman.
It's like, I was about to say
it's
Batman.
Like the Birdman.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think in some ways, like everybody just kind of like fell into place, you know, fell into that dynamic, you know. Taylor becomes Taylor.
Do you have any lines in these new episodes?
Yes, I do.
Oh, you get great.
Yeah.
Maybe the troubadour is Rory's new boyfriend.
Oh, wow, that would be weird.
But
that'd
you
be
can weird. Confirm nor deny. You can neither confirm nor deny.
Right.
Oh, that'd be a new rumor.
She likes music.
She does.
I always wanted. Truthfully, I did not know why the troubadour and Hep Alien did not collaborate. Do a nice collabo on something, right? Lane's band? Why would they never get together?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, the troubadour has a, I don't know, my sense of the troubadour, if I may speak of him.
Yeah, what do you think is his, like, backstory, his history, his
life?
He's
very James Lipton, isn't he?
Yes. What is your favorite curse word? Yes.
I don't know. I mean, he's very temperamental, you know, and I don't know. I don't know that he would collaborate so well, you know.
Oh,
he seems to have
a
real issue about, you know, territory and...
well, that's true, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, deeply rooted stuff that, you know, I don't know, we could spend more time here on the couch talking about.
Yeah, well, you'd have to be lying down.
Right.
Horizontally.
Right.
Oh, man. Yeah, okay. So, in new episodes, got some lines. Are you in multiple episodes, or?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay, so there's one that we can look forward to seeing the town troubadour in.
That's right.
All right.
Yes, followed by an all-new Smallville.
On a fresh Supernatural. Wait, you got that guy down good.
Yeah.
The WB voiceover guy. Oh, man. Mm. Well, when can we expect a soundtrack of Town Troubadour dropping fresh Stars Hollow? Wouldn't that be rad if they put together like a Spotify
they
thing?
Should.
Or like a session? That seems like
that's
a slam
great
dunk.
Idea.
Yeah, it seems
right?
Like a no-brainer.
I love that.
Oh, I got a few. Some of them I have to say for off mic so no one else takes
okay.
them. But I mean, listen, we're going to take you places. I'm telling
yes,
you.
Yes, like hands.
Yeah, that's right.
These are just all inventions in general.
Do you still do magic tricks, by the way?
I've sort of lost my knack of sleight of hand, you know. But I do appreciate it, though. I used to go to the Magic Castle a lot and see, you know, fellow musicians / magicians, you know.
Sean Gunn goes to the Magic Castle.
Does he really?
Yeah, I think so.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, there are those of us who play music that also do magic. David Lovering, drummer of band Pixies.
Mm-hmm.
He's a fantastic magician.
Really?
Did you know that? Yeah. Rob Zabrecki, singer of a band called Possum Dixon. Great, great magician.
Are you guys part of a secret club?
Well, they are. I suppose
you've been
I
trying
am.
To get in for a while.
I've been trying to get in. But yeah, I mean, those guys, they perform at the castle and elsewhere. Yeah.
Right on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand you have a new record out.
I do.
Is that a good transition?
My mind, for a moment, I was back in Highland Park. I saw a great mural today that said, veganism is magic. And it had a wizard. Yeah.
I'd be interested in breaking that
yeah,
down.
I
want
to talk to the creator.
Eating habits are magic. Veganism is magic.
Yeah.
Man, who am I to say? I'm not vegan. Are you
I'm
vegan?
Not either. No. I've tried. And what
you
happened?
Did try?
I did try when I first went out on the road, and I wound up eating mashed potatoes, baked potatoes, French fries, and potato chips. I was on a potato diet.
Yeah.
And okay. I started kind of becoming a potato.
Yeah, well, because that's all fair game under veganism.
Yeah,
I was starch. Vegan for a little bit, and it was very much just eating like potatoes and just being like, well, candy is still.
That's pretty much veganism. Part. Yeah.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Some of it is. There's stuff with like gelatin and whatnot.
Sure.
Oh, that's hooves though, right?
Yeah.
Veganism is magic.
It's magic.
So your new album is called Veganism is Magic.
That's right.
With yes. the number one hit single, No Milk, No Wonder. No, but your new record out. Let's talk
it's called,
about this.
Yeah, it's called The Narrows. And it's a whole different, it's my serious side, I suppose. Okay. Yeah.
It's a frowny face of a record.
Well, you know, serious, I don't look real happy serious. On the cover. You know, but it's a bit.
Are those shoots fun when you do like a cover art shoot? Or is
my wife took the photograph, and she's a great photographer to begin with. So I'm very blessed, you know, in that way. That one, she's my wife, and that she will put up with me and take my pictures. But it's usually the case of us going out. We got to shoot a picture, and then I'll like, oh, it's not working. It doesn't feel right. And when I've got that look on my face, that's when she goes snap.
Oh, so that she frustrates you on purpose?
Yeah, it's like a weird kind of like
okay.
Kubrick kind of like methody, you know,
160th take for the
yeah,
Grammy Phillips
yeah. When
cover.
I'm right okay. there on the edge, about to explode, that's when she knows she's got her moment.
Oh man,
yeah.
But The Narrows, and it's kind of continuing in the tradition of singing more and digging into those like rootsy stories.
Yeah, I think of it as being much more of that kind of, you know, my wheelhouse as. Folks say here in LA.
Yes. Do they not say that in Nashville? There's no wheelhouses.
As much. There's no. It seems like that's where there would be a lot more wheelhouses.
Yeah.
Back.
I don't know
back
what our
east.
Wheelhouses are doing.
On
here.
A statistical level, it seems strange they would be in LA.
We don't have any place to put them.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Mm. Yeah. You know. Yeah. I think it's kind of like a, you know, me and the acoustic guitar and like I said, you know, telling stories and singing and. Yeah, organic, earthy stuff. I think of it as being earthy, mm-hmm. but maybe, you know, kind of etheric. That was the word I heard the other day.
Etheric?
Well, you know, I mean, music's more than music. It's more than just the notes and the, you know, it's, I don't know. I think it's not just the melody. It's not just the words. It's something that happens in between all that kind of stuff, you know, spirit, this mm-hmm. sort of, this third element. Third element?
Yeah, the third element. Not the fifth element, the third element.
Yeah, right. That's what music, you know, has to offer.
Yeah.
The invisible thing.
At its best. Well, we'd love to hear a song from this new album.
Shall I do that? I'll
if
do
you'd
that.
You'd like to play one for
yeah.
us.
Yeah.
I'd like to play one.
Oh, so this is a match made in heaven.
This is perfect.
All right. So what's this song? What are we about
this
to
This song is, this is a new song. It's called Rolling Pin. It's sort of a kitchen metaphor. I suppose the song is sort of about that very passionate, kind of explosive quality of love.
Oh, boy.
That only a kitchen metaphor can really
of course,
get to the
of
heart
course
of.
Of course, only a kitchen metaphor.
Yeah, yeah. But a rolling pin. I don't know. I couldn't work in spatula.
Yeah. Like a rolling pin.
Yeah, like a rolling. It just rolls off your tongue.
Yeah,
you know?
That's right.
Spatula. Mm, ladle.
Yeah.
That's dead.
That's a first and second draft. This is the final.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
This is so good.
Okay, here we go. Flat out, lay me down like dough beneath the rolling pin. No, I've never seen the likes of her. I knew I never would again. Heart, don't you fail me now. Don't give me more than I can take. Flat out, lay me down. Enough to take my breath away. Set much aside to put a roof above our heads. Made a little bit of money mopping top, wanted up beside the bed. We took the Oranchero north, wasn't in the mood to wait. Set our vows in a Reno chapel on a cold November day. Flat out laid me down like dough beneath the rolling pin. You know I never met the likes of her. I knew I never would again. Heart, don't you fail me now. Don't give me more than I can take.
flat out weigh me down enough to take my breath away. Got a work cut out for sure, aims to make a man of me. Takes a woman's touch to train a monkey how to wear a leash. But every night I get to come back home's another that I'm truly blessed. I need no proof to show me where I stand or put a loving to the test. Flat out lay me down like dough beneath the rolling pin. No one ever seen the likes of her, knew I never would again. Heart, don't you fail me now, don't give me more than I can take. Flat out, lay me down, enough to take my breath away. Flat out, you lay me down, enough to take my breath away, yeah. Flat out.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
Oh my gosh.
You. Oh man.
We do not deserve such a beautiful private concert.
Master of Knives.
Oh, that from the Master of Knives, Grant Lee Phelps.
The debut track title.
Oh man.
Like, well, dough beneath a pile of knives.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
right.
There you
yeah.
go.
Yeah. Believe me, I'm sending this thing to Rachel Ray.
Oh yeah. Oh, it's gonna be it should be her new theme song.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh man, well Grant, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you both.
This has been such a delight.
True. Thank you, Gilmore guys.
Where can people find you? And then we'll have you plug your social media stuff. And then someone you're enjoying in music yourself, someone whose music you're super into now.
Oh goodness, goodness, goodness. Oh boy. who would that be? I mean, Sam Phillips, by the way. Who we are wonderful. Not relation, but I am always here to endorse Sam
sure.
Phillips.
Oh, who wouldn't?
Most definitely. Where do you find me? I think I have locations on generally in my settings, but
yeah.
Otherwise, you can always just go to grantleephillips.com, and, okay. that has my tour dates. I'm fixing to go to Europe mid April. I'll be in Europe on tour. In mid-May, I'll be on tour in the USA, beginning in Seattle, working my way down the West Coast, all the way to San Francisco. And yeah, I'm all over the place. The album's called The Narrows.
Yeah, and you can find that on iTunes.
Yeah.
Amazon iTunes. Music.
Mm-hmm.
Spotify. Do we want to plug Spotify? How do you feel about
Why
Spotify?
Not? No, I think it has its place.
All right.
You know, sure. Yeah, it's not going away, you know. And no, I think it certainly has its place in the grand scheme of all these things.
Right on.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Should we sing the theme song to Gilmore Girls to close
I think
us
should.
Out? Would that would
I'd
that
like
feel
to try.
Right?
I've never sang it before.
Really?
Really?
Well, not in public.
but you know it in your.
I know it. Oh yeah.
You're
yeah.
all into.
Oh,
all
I can right. see. I can see that foliage when I think of that song. When I hear it,
it sounds like I autumn,
see that
right?
Yeah. It's the sound of autumn.
All right. So here we go. Where you leave,
if you're out on the road, feeling lonely and so cold.
Woo.
All you have to do is call my name and I'll be there on the next train. Where you leave, I will follow
anywhere.
That you tell me
tell
to
me.
If you need me to be with you.
Oh, come on now.
Follow. Oh, oh, oh.
Oh,
where you lead, I will follow. Anywhere that you tell me to, if you need.
Oh, come on now. Oh, yeah.
I will follow where you lead.
I like that song.
I love that. Yeah.
That felt good.
Grant Lee Phillips, everybody.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
We did it.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.